You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll meet the new host of WPR's morning show here on the Ideas Network and talk about her plans and hopes for the program. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. Shirley Abrahamson has been a justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court since 1976, was the first woman to serve in that capacity. She announced this week she will not seek another term. Also this week, Attorney General Brad Schimmel said that all of the backlogged Wisconsin rape kits are on their way for testing and will be analyzed by the end of the year. We'll find out what led to that move. And Wisconsin Democrats are holding their state convention this weekend. We'll get a preview of what's on the agenda and how candidates are hoping to stand out in the race for governor. J.R. Ross is the editor of WisPolitics.com and joins us to dig into these stories. J.R., good to have you back.
Anytime.
Well, let's start with the announcement this week that Justice Shirley Abrahamson will not be seeking re-election to the state's Supreme Court. Now, talk about her career on the court. It's been going a long time.
Oh, I mean, there are a lot of firsts with Shirley Abrahamson. I mean, the first woman to serve on the court, first woman chief justice, longest-serving justice, longest-serving chief justice. I mean, you cannot underestimate the impact she's had on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, the imprint she's left on the judicial system in Wisconsin. I mean, like, it goes on, and that's part of it's just the longevity. You know, she was appointed to the court in 1976. I was 3 years old when she got on the court, right? I mean, that's a remarkable tenure on the bench.
And she started, like, kind of a lot of justices have, by being, as you said, appointed by a governor, and then she ran for re-election and kept winning these 10-year terms.
Yeah, and let's not underestimate, when she was appointed, there were questions about, you know, could she win a statewide race? This, I think we're talking like the, you know, mid-70s she got appointed. It was unusual to have a female justice, and she had to go out there and earn it. And then she earned it over and over again. When she announced her decision not to seek re-election, she pointed out that she won each time with, I believe, 55% of the vote or more, and one time touched 65%. So, I mean, this is, you know, a fairly impressive record.
Can you talk about her role on the partisan breakup of the court, increasingly partisan breakdown in the court?
You know, and as I talked to somebody this week, he said, when you run the show and things aren't going well, you have to show us on the blame, right? So we saw the court become increasingly partisan now. There are a lot of factors for that, right? I mean, for one, you have personalities on the bench like you have in any job, so that's going to play a part of it. Two, look at the races, how they developed in the mid-2000s. I mean, when I first started covering Wisconsin politics, we had a couple of races in a row where the justices weren't even challenged, were up for re-election. They never took a pass on them because the thought was, it's so tough to beat an incumbent justice, why bother? Well, then we had an open seat in 2007 that Annette Ziegler won. We saw the first kind of real role of outside groups coming in. Justice Lewis Butler lost in 2008, the first incumbent to lose since the 1960s, I think it was. And we've seen the role of outside groups kind of flourish, and with it, see more partisanship. And then we also saw an incident between Justice Ann Walsh Bradley and David Prosser that got a lot of attention. You know, I mean, there's all kinds of stuff like that that really have, you know, brought a little bit of, took some shine off the court there for a few years.
Yeah, talking about when there are reports about physical altercations allegedly on your state Supreme Court, that's not the kind of headline you want as a Chief Justice.
No, when you had, like, Justice Gableman, who the court split on disciplining him over a TV ad he ran in that 08 campaign against Justice Butler. Ziegler was hit with an ethics thing about hearing cases when she was in Washington County. But, I mean, just a series of things that kind of didn't really shine a very pretty light on the Supreme Court there for a while.
And before we move on from this announcement, take a look ahead at the election. Are people already lining up to run for this seat on the court?
We heard immediately after Justice Abrahamson announced she wasn't seeking re-election, Appeals Court Chief Judge Lisa Neubauer said she was going to look at it. We talked to Milwaukee County Judge David Borowski this week, who said he's going to take a look at it. Brian Hagedorn, who's an Appeals Court judge, had already been talking about running for the seat before Justice Abrahamson made her announcement. So people are going to kick the tires. It's an open seat. What's really important about this race, though, is that with Rebecca Dallet winning an open seat in April, once we get to her being sworn in later this summer, it'll be a 4-3 conservative majority. The conservatives, or the liberals, have to hold Abrahamson's seat next year to have a shot in 2020 to flip control of the Supreme Court, because then Justice Kelly is up, who's appointed by Governor Walker. So this is really a kind of a make-or-break moment where, for liberals, if you win that seat, you've got a shot. If you're conservatives, and you take the seat, then you have a cushion that's what happens in 2020, you still have control of the court. So it's going to be a big deal next year.
Talking to J.R. Ross from Wisp Politics about some of the top stories in Wisconsin news this week. Let's move on to this announcement, J.R., from Attorney General Brad Schimmel, looking at these untested rape kits. A 2015 review found that nearly 7,000 rape kits had not been tested in the state. There's been a process to try to catalog them and then get them tested. What's the new development here from the Attorney General?
Basically, that they have sent the last of those backlog kits off to labs to be tested. I mean, this is a very big issue for Brad Schimmel. I mean, this issue's been around for a while. It became an issue back in when Peg Lautenschlager was Attorney General back in the mid-2000s. J.B. Van Hollen, when he was Attorney General, focused on it a lot. Now we have it again. And, you know, for Schimmel, this is an important issue to kind of try and take off the table or to address because he's up for election this fall. But I can tell you that his opponents already have the ads pretty much written in their minds because to them, this is a signal of a failure of his leadership. But also they're in contrast the backlog with the money he spent on swag. I mean, there are stories a year or two ago about spending money on coins that have the phrase a kick-ass every day on them, you know, other swag that he got with a DOJ emblem on him. Now, there's a reason why he did that, and he can justify that. But for opponents, they're going to contrast this backlog with that money being spent. And I'm not saying that it's necessarily fair or right, but this is politics, right? You have an opportunity, if you're an opponent of Brad Schimmel, to say, this guy spent money on coins when he didn't take care of the backlog. And it's going to be something he has to deal with and address, show progress on ahead of this fall.
And not all of the pieces of physical evidence, I understand, will be tested. There are some categories, like ones where the victim didn't want to pursue this any further, things like that. So that whole 7,000 number, not every single one of those pieces of evidence ends up going to a lab, it sounds like.
Yes, and every time you have, you know, if there's anybody who they find because they tested it now versus testing when they first got the sample, that could be an issue for Schimmel as well, where it's a good thing to go capture, you know, find this person and close a case, but also could raise questions of, well, why didn't you do it sooner? So for him, good thing to do to try and get this stuff, you know, tested. How does he kind of message this issue going forward to try and address what could be a weakness for him?
Now moving on to an election issue. I know how you're spending your weekend, JR, at the Wisconsin Democratic Party convention. The Republicans had their convention a couple weeks back. Can you talk about, first of all, what happens at one of these things?
Well, basically, it's kind of like a motivational speech for the for the activists. And why I say that is, you know, both parties do these every year. The people who come are people who will man the phone banks, who will, you know, put yard signs up, who will go do doors, who get involved in campaigns. So this is an opportunity for them to hear directly from the people that they're going to work for as kind of like a quick, you know, go get them kind of thing, a motivational speech. There's that. It's also going to be a chance for this crowded gubernatorial field to make a direct pitch to the activists of, hey, I'm the strongest candidate because of, you know, A, B, or C. You know, for a lot of these candidates, I mean, like Tony Evers, state superintendent, he's on the ballot four times. He's won statewide three times. People kind of know who he is. But for some of these other candidates, they're not nearly as well known. They haven't been on the ballot the way that Evers has. This is a chance to kind of help get a little more name ID with these folks, you know, and then these folks who go to convention, they'll go home and tell their neighbors, you know, I saw so-and-so speak, and he or she really impressed me. I think you should give him a look. And when you're talking, there are nine camps we focused on for the most part in this race. There are 10 who have turning enough signatures with the party to qualify to speak at convention, it's kind of hard to get traction, a lot of attention. And we're also not seeing them up on paid media right now. So what we're watching for is who can raise enough money between now and maybe mid-July to do a sustained 3 to 4 week media buy ahead of this August 14th primary, because until then, the average voter is not seeing these guys. Even though they're doing events around the state, they're talking to people, doing shows, they're just not being, it's not a very high-profile thing. They need to get out there on TV and radio to kind of capture some attention and maybe get some momentum ahead of that primary.
And a straw poll will happen, and in one sense, it's completely meaningless. It doesn't win you the official party nod to get that nomination, and some candidates are saying, hey, we don't care about the straw poll. On the other hand, if maybe a lesser-known candidate can make a splash in this, it's one way to stand out from the crowd.
Yeah, I mean, the campaigns kind of approach these things in an interesting way that they don't want to seem like they're overtly trying hard to win, because in case they don't, but they still want to do well. And we historically do straw polls at the party convention, so if you come to our website tomorrow sometime in the afternoon, you'll see how it turned out. But for these campaigns, it's an early opportunity to show organization. That might seem kind of odd that, like, well, there might be 1,500 people this weekend. What's that mean? But you're trying to get your supporters to do something. You're trying to show that you can organize them, encourage them to go. You get some attention. I mean, it's just a chance to get a little boost out of convention, because now we're, you know, think about it. We're here the first day of June. This primary now is, what, a month and a half away, 2 months away, whatever it is. So we're getting to crunch time. It's an opportunity to kind of get a little boost and try and ride that into maybe some more donations, maybe some more attention, and then, like, get that paid media campaign ahead of the primary and really get your name out there.
JR, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, anytime.
That was J.R. Ross. He's the editor of WisPolitics.com. He joined us for our weekly look at some of the top news stories from around the state. And starting today, we will run WPR news profiles of Democratic hopefuls and of Governor Walker at 4:55 and 6:55 each evening. You can also find them at WPR.org. First, you'll hear a new voice on the Ideas Network's The Morning Show starting on Monday. Veteran journalist Carrie Kaufman takes over as host from Kate Archer Kent, who returns to her role as fill-in host on Wisconsin Public Radio programs. Since arriving at WPR about a month ago, Carrie has been getting to know Wisconsin and studying up on the issues that'll be covered on The Morning Show. And she's eager to get it settled in and hear what's on the minds of listeners around the state. We talked with her earlier to learn more about her background and her plans for The Morning Show. Carrie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Well, give us a little taste of who you were, you know, before coming to Wisconsin.
Who I was before coming to Wisconsin. You know,
important part starts now in Wisconsin. But.
That is true. My background is as a theater person and as a journalist. So for 23 years, I published a theater newspaper that was a lot like Backstage. It was called Perform Inc. in Chicago. It still exists online. I just don't do it anymore. And then got into radio. Got into radio quite by accident, partly because I was doing interviews on stories that I was doing. So I was a guest on shows like yours and mine. And then in 2007, there was something called the Public Radio Talent Quest, and I did voiceovers. I was an actor. I did theater stuff. So I put something together and threw it up online and went out of town and forgot about it, and then came back and checked the web, and so many people had listened to it, and I ended up in the top 10 of that.
And I'll say for the people who can't see at home, you're very theatrical. You gesture a lot when you're talking. And I do this, too, even though I don't have a theater background. There's a lot of action and movement going on in
this
interview.
Yes, I always use my hands when I move. It's really important for me to be able to be animated and talk, yes.
And you're coming here from Vegas.
I'm coming here from Las Vegas. I grew up in Las Vegas, so I was in Chicago for 23 years, went back to Vegas about 4.5 years ago with my then 11-year-old daughters, and started working at KNPR in Chicago, Nevada Public Radio, as a host of their morning show, their one-hour morning show.
And people might hear, oh, you're coming here to Wisconsin from Vegas, watch out for the winter. You're in Chicago.
I know winter, yeah. And I love winter. And I've always said, I will take a Midwest winter over a Vegas summer any day, no problem.
Yeah, Vegas, okay, that too hot.
Too hot. Way, way, way too hot. I can put on a coat. I can put on gloves. I can put on a hat.
At some point, you have to stop taking clothing off.
Right, exactly.
by law, actually.
By law.
And what, now you're living here in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
You just got here, basically. So far, I know you're settling in, but what are your thoughts on Wisconsin?
So I love Madison. When I heard that this job was actually based in Madison, I was like, absolutely. I would love to move to Madison, Wisconsin. It's one of my favorite places to visit. And I love, you know, I've always been a Green Bay fan. I know that sounds really like I'm pandering, but I'm not pandering. Growing up in Las Vegas, I refuse to be an L.A. Rams fan, so I chose the Packers because of their storied history. So it was like sort of like coming to the Holy Grail for me.
That's great. So you're going to get up to, speaking of the pattern, I was going to say you're going to go up to Lambert Field.
Which
a presidential candidate once said on a visit.
Oh, no.
You're going to get up to Lambeau at some point.
I actually got up to Lambeau. I was there a few weeks ago, and the people up in the Green Bay Bureau took me around, and I got to visit Lambeau. But yeah, I would love to get up for a game at some point if that's absolutely possible.
Yeah, get on that list right away.
Yeah, right, exactly.
For the show, as a news host, a talk show host, what kind of topics do you come in with a lot of interest in?
You know, I tend to come in with sort of like bigger issue topics that that I want to examine kind of in chunks so we can get our arms around it. The politics is totally a passion of mine, and we are coming into a political season. This is a really interesting state to cover. It's something that I've been following this state, even though I have not been living here. Immigration is a big thing right now. So, and I've done a lot of immigration stories in Las Vegas just because of the population in Las Vegas. So I have some insight into that, and we'll be bringing that. Things like race in America, which I think we need to be talking about more. And that's one of the things that I think that a talk show can do really well, more than packaged pieces. A talk show, we can actually hear from people about and hear about their experiences. So I'm looking forward to digging into that.
Yeah, what do you think about doing live radio versus the packaged stuff? We've both done both over the years. I love live.
I love live. I love talking to people. I love the surprise of the callers or of the people who come on Twitter. And I'm going to be pushing that a little bit more, people to get in touch with us through social media, not just call, because there are lots of ways that people can interact with us, and we need to do more of that.
Yeah, it's funny. I kind of forget. It can be really intimidating to call in and be on the radio for me. We kind of take it for granted on this side. Once, when I was in college, I called into a talk radio show, and I almost had a panic attack.
Right.
And I started just rambling and rambling until the host cut me off, for which I was eternally grateful. But it's not everybody's going to feel that comfort level to come on and call.
Right. People do. So, yeah. So, you know, people can get in touch with me. My Twitter account is a work Twitter account, and it's just Carrie Kaufman at Twitter, or at Carrie Kaufman. So people can get in touch with me, tweet me there, and I will respond to those messages, and we will use some of them on the air.
Talking to Carrie Kaufman. She starts as the morning show host here on the Ideas Network Monday morning.
Monday morning.
The question you'll probably get asked the most as the morning show host is, the hours, how do you deal with that? You're ready to rock, though.
You know, I'm totally ready to rock. We did a morning show in Las Vegas. I had to be in at 7. I had to get my kids to school. So I would get up at 5 anyway. So I'm getting up about an hour earlier. It's not that big of a deal.
And you're high-functioning at that time of day.
I'm high-functioning at that time of day. As long as I have some caffeine, I'm good.
Good, good. I'll warn you, we don't make great coffee in this building.
I have noticed that.
I just brought my own. BMO, yeah. So what is on the schedule next week on the morning show?
Next week, we're going to start out with an introduction to Wisconsin for me. Wisconsin's birthday is coming up 170 years, and we're going to be talking to somebody from the Historical Society about the things that I need to know about Wisconsin, the things that people are most proud of, secrets that people have that that most people don't know that they want to share with me and with our other listeners. People who live in different parts of the state might not even know the secrets of each other. So we're going to start out with that. That's going to be a really fun thing. We're going to look at, you know, the Democratic Convention is happening this weekend. So we're going to talk to Sean and Laurel about that and about the gubernatorial candidates, who's in, who's out, who's got the best shot at being the Democratic candidate. We know that Scott Walker is pretty much going to be a lock here. He's got an inside track. So we're going to check in with them for the 7 o'clock hour. And then for the 8 o'clock hour, we're going to look at immigration. We're going to look at all these rumors that have been swirling around about 1,500 kids lost and kids being taken away from their parents and what's really happening. And is the Trump administration really deporting more people than Obama did? Because Obama did deport a lot of people. So we're going to be looking at that in context.
And then on a fun note, it is approaching. It feels like summer in Wisconsin. It's basically summer. We can call it that. Do you have some maybe summer weekend travel plans, places you want to hit around the state, or are you looking for suggestions?
I am totally looking for suggestions. I have promised myself that I am going to get back into paddling now that I'm here and live on lakes. So that's one of the things that I'm moving towards. And I want to do some more biking. I've never been to Kettle Moraine. I've always wanted to hike Kettle Moraine. So that's, I'm going to head over there sometime this summer. But anything else, please let me know.
Devil's Lake. Have you been there yet?
No.
So that is, I think, if you named one state park that you'd take somebody from out of state to, Devil's Lake. And you can paddle there. You can paddle on the lake with the bluffs looming over you on either side. That'd be a good start. Hmm. So you are looking for feedback from people. You mentioned the Twitter account.
Right.
Can people send you some holiday summer vacation ideas while they're there?
Absolutely. At Carrie Kaufman at Twitter, yes.
So looking forward to Monday. Excited?
I am excited, yeah. Yeah, I'm finally getting, I've been here a month. I've been traveling the state a little bit, kind of getting to know how things work and figuring out the whole coffee situation. And now I'm like, I'm ready to be on the air.
Well, have fun.
Thank you very much.
Carrie Kaufman is the new host of The Morning Show on Wisconsin Public Radio. She'll make her debut Monday at 6. A new Harvard study finds nearly 4,600 people died in Puerto Rico as a result of Hurricane Maria. That's more than 70 times higher than the official death toll, which stands at just 64. The research out earlier this week is renewing questions about why the official count is so low and about the Puerto Rican government's lack of transparency when it comes to the way it calculates the number of people who died as a result of the storm. Aurelis Hernandez is a reporter for The Washington Post covering the aftermath of Hurricane Maria. She's from Puerto Rico, lived there for 2 months earlier this year. Aurelis, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you open a recent piece for The Post with a story of one woman's death in Puerto Rico. Tell us about Yvette Leon.
Well, Yvette Leon was a 50-plus-year-old mother of two adult children. She was active in her local Boy Scouts. She was a community leader. She was the kind of person who, when, you know, this blackout happened, gave all her neighbors whistles so that they could, you know, sound off in an emergency amid the darkness. She was moderately healthy. She didn't have any chronic diseases per her family. And she got sick around Thanksgiving Day. This was several weeks after she had gone about sort of giving out donations to some of the harder hit towns in Puerto Rico. And she got very, very sick. She was vomiting. She had chills. She found blood in her stool. She went to the hospital, was never admitted, but was treated through an IV and got some prescription antibiotics and was told that she had diverticulitis. About 18 hours after she went to the hospital, again, having never been admitted, just got getting this IV in the emergency room and being told to go home, she died. She died in her daughter's arms before paramedics could get there on time to try to administer any kind of life-saving help. And this is just one story. There are many stories like this where there was an issue either with access to health care or there was an issue with some sort of mysterious ailment that came about or access to paramedics or help of any kind that resulted in the death of a loved one in Puerto Rico.
And, yeah, a lot of those stories where, in this case, the paramedics couldn't get there quickly enough in part because of infrastructure trouble, I understand, lack of power to power medical supplies, things like that. A lot of people died indirectly as a result in some ways of the hurricane. That's not counted in the official death toll.
Well, we actually don't know how the Puerto Rican government is counting these deaths. So according to CDC guidelines, some of the issues that arise after a natural disaster, something like, you know, the collapse of the electrical system and someone dying as a result of that system not being in place, could potentially be included in what is a list of attributable deaths. But because we don't actually know what guidelines, what protocols the Puerto Rican government is using to classify and certify these deaths, I wouldn't be able to tell you one way or the other, you know, who they're saying is in and who they're saying is out.
And what is this Harvard study doing differently to find really 70 times more deaths as a result of the hurricane?
Right. So the Harvard study, it was a household survey, right? And they're estimating, they're using the little bit of data that was provided by the Department of Health and Demographic Registry for, I think it was September, October, November. It was incomplete data. But data to sort of estimate and take surveys from household to household that they chose that would be a representative sample to sort of get an idea of, you know, these stories and how many people died. And their estimate, remember we're talking about a range there, the sort of the median range was 4,000, more than 4,600, but their range included anywhere from about 800 to 8,000 in terms of the number of people who may have actually died in this natural disaster. Now, when they say the number of people died, we're talking about in excess of what the number of people who typically die in a certain time frame or time period. And so Harvard is not saying that all of these are attributable to the hurricane. What they're saying is up to this number of people, many people died during this time period in excess of what is the norm.
As I understand it, this isn't just an argument about getting the past right, getting the history right in these numbers. It's also about preparing for the next hurricane season, which starts, I think, today.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely starts today. I mean, you have a Puerto Rico now that still has about 11,000 power customers without electricity. If we were to extrapolate that and assume that 2 to 3 people live in every household, we're talking about 30,000 people who've been living without electricity, I think now for more than 8 months. And so, you know, in a system that has been publicly sort of declared not ready for another hurricane, I mean, certainly there would be few systems, you know, capable of withstanding a Category 5 or 4 storm, but Puerto Rico system in particular is sort of in patch mode. The federal government and the local government have not even entered that phase where they can harden the system to such a degree. And it was in large part because of those issues with electricity that it crippled every part of this system from, you know, hospitals and medical emergency medical personnel to being able to get on the phone and access information or getting your prescriptions that led to a lot of the deaths that we saw occur in the aftermath of the storm.
We're talking to Aurelis Hernandez, a reporter with the Washington Post, about the death toll in Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. New research says the numbers are actually much higher than the official estimates. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about how the government responded after Hurricane Maria? Do you think we've been paying enough attention to what's been a slow recovery on this American territory? Do you have family yourself in Puerto Rico who were affected by the hurricane? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. We continue our conversation about the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. A new study says the death toll is likely much higher than the official count, and the island in many ways not ready for the new hurricane season. Aurelis Hernandez is with us from the Washington Post. She's been covering the aftermath of the hurricane. Aurelis, you shared on Twitter some of your notes. You surveyed mayors around Puerto Rico, asked them, are you ready now for the new hurricane season? What kind of responses did you get?
Oh, that was actually Leila Santiago from CNN. Yeah, no, but that's okay. I mean, I think unequivocally, I think her notes, I saw that tweet as well, was that no one seems to have any degree of confidence that they are ready for the hurricane season, should another one like Maria come by.
And talking to people on Puerto Rico, on the island itself after the hurricane, do you get a sense that they feel forgotten by the rest of the United States?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's across the board. I talked to hundreds of people in my 3 or 4 trips now back and forth to Puerto Rico, and that's the predominant sentiment, is this feeling of having been abandoned and forgotten, you know, while this struggle continues for a lot of the folks who live there.
And one thing that struck me about some of the reporting that you and your colleagues at the Post have done is, apart from the fatalities and the tragedies, the schools. A lot of kids, at least for a semester, their schools were empty. They weren't ready to accept students. You had teachers showing up at empty schools waiting for the day when kids come back.
Right. No, we did a piece, an immersive sort of digital experience where we looked at one particular school in the town of Utuado. And yes, there were many, many schools across the island in the 2, 3, 4 months after the storm that didn't have water or electricity and could not be open. And for so many of those communities, those schools are a central sort of network and community center for a lot of these families. In some cases, you know, for poorer families, the only place where they will get a hot meal, you know, reliably once or twice a day. And so, you know, the program of closing some of these schools, the territorial government, because of cost savings, because of enrollment issues, we're talking about somewhere near 300 schools are expected to close, I think, in the next month.
And also in that immersive multimedia project, the sound of generators in many communities, generators meant to, you know, tide you over for a day or two here and there, people trying to live off of them for months at a time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you didn't have a generator, you didn't have a way to keep your refrigerator cool. If you were diabetic, you didn't have a means by which to keep your insulin cool. And so for a lot of people, the power generator became a lifeline. They'd spend, you know, the couple $100 it needed, and then we're spending in excess of $40 to $60 a week to put in the gas and to get change the oil and whatnot, but and turn it on for only a certain number of hours, either overnight or in the evening, and that was ubiquitous. I mean, around 6 o'clock as the sun was falling, and I remember around November, like, it was just like, just clicked on, the sound of the power generator was, the buzzing, that is, was even louder than the native frogs that sing out there.
For months after the hurricane, we heard about problems accessing safe, clean drinking water. What's the situation now?
The situation has greatly improved, and so a lot of Puerto Rico's water system is a system of water pumps and wells. And so when the electricity went out, a lot of these wells didn't have the power to be able to run those pumps to get them going. FEMA actually intervened in that and provided many generators, and still to this day there are a number of these pumps, particularly in rural and mountainous communities, where these power generators are keeping that lifeline alive. Also keep in mind, if there were a lot of landslides in the center of the island, and so a lot of the piping and the infrastructure was damaged by some of the geographic dislodgement that or the ground moving, essentially. And so things are much better now. There's a much more reliable sort of source of water, but as long as that you know, that generator is going, as long as there's some kind of backup system for these water pumps, it will continue to serve folks out there.
And briefly, as we wrap up, again, a new hurricane season starts today. Is the infrastructure being rebuilt in a way that would hopefully, to the extent it has been rebuilt, in a way that will hopefully be able to weather future storms?
The last I checked, there were plans to make that, to build Puerto Rico stronger. The problem is that things have taken so long to get back to a sense of normalcy that it's unclear whether, you know, the actual building has taken place. There are a few new bridges across rural communities that collapse across rivers that are temporary fixes. But in terms of hardening that infrastructure, I'm not clear on the evidence that that's actually taking place.
We'll leave it there for now. Aurelis, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Aurelis Hernandez, a reporter for The Washington Post, covering the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. She was with us to talk about conditions on the island now and a new study that finds the death toll from Hurricane Maria was likely much, much higher than the official count. For the next few weeks, Wisconsin Public Radio will air profiles of almost a dozen candidates for governor. We begin today with a look at Governor Scott Walker, who's seeking his third term. As Sean Johnson reports, the lack of a clear Democratic challenger has given Walker a chance to run an upbeat campaign.
When Scott Walker stopped at a Shopko department store near Pewaukee to promote his new $100 per child tax credit, the mood was relaxed and so was the governor. About a dozen reporters showed up to watch, and about a dozen employees did too. Walker talked with a few of them on his way in about what he'd heard from a parent of 10 kids at a previous stop.
She said, "Here are my kids. That's a grand right there." I said, "Wow."
As he moved to a microphone set up in front of the kids' sportswear section, Walker said the child tax credit was another way to give back to taxpayers. He said Democrats who call the checks election year bribes are really just knocking him.
Let's just be honest here. stay Democrats, you fill in the blank. They're opposed to whatever I'm for.
The approach has carried over to Walker's advertising. He's run 4 TV ads, mostly featuring people who got private sector jobs with the help of state government.
Yeah, it gives us a leg up.
Wisconsin is working.
Larry Sabato is the director of the Center for Politics at the University of Virginia. He says there's a chance Walker's positive approach is aimed more at Democratic voters than it is Republicans.
Maybe he's trying to melt a little of the intensity of the Democrats in opposing him.
The last few years, however, have not been without controversy. In 2014, Walker dismissed suggestions that he would sign a right-to-work law or run for president. In 2015, he did both. And last year, Walker negotiated a contract that could pay tech giant Foxconn up to $4.5 billion in taxpayer money to build TV screens in Wisconsin. Democratic Congressman Mark Pocan of Madison says he tells the governor's opponents that Foxconn is their ticket to beat Walker.
I have told them all the exact same thing, that Foxconn is radioactive toxic across the state.
But there are at least some Democrats who worry that their party still hasn't figured out what it takes to beat the governor. Democratic consultant Scott Witkoff, who is advising Mike McCabe in the governor's race, says it's not enough to just attack Walker.
The problem with that is that that resonates with the choir. And the slice of the pie in terms of political discourse that aligns with the choir has been shrinking.
Former conservative talk radio host Jerry Bader, who's now the communications director for Media Trackers, thinks Democrats have demonized Walker so much that they've lost credibility.
A lot of the gloom and doom stuff that they predicted did not come to pass.
Walker has even gone so far as to suggest this year that Democrats are filled with anger and hatred toward him. He references a comment by State Superintendent of Public Instruction Tony Evers, who called Walker an idiot for rejecting federal Medicaid funds.
I think a lot of voters are shocked to think that people that hold office would call other people in office things like that.
There is, of course, a more prominent office holder who uses insults as a political tool all the time.
Comey's a liar and a leaker. Maxine Waters, a very low IQ individual.
President Donald Trump, the leader of the Republican Party, used insults to get elected and continues to use them in the White House. Walker supports the president, but downplays suggestions that Trump makes his case more difficult.
You know, Washington is a whole different place, but I think the contrast is if people don't like what's happening in Washington with anybody, Democrat, Republican alike, if they don't like the tone there, we're the cure to that.
Walker's political instincts have served him well in Wisconsin, where he's won 3 statewide elections in the past 8 years. But at least 10 Democrats are hoping they'll be the one to end the winning streak. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, the state's Department of Corrections says it will stop the use of pepper spray in Wisconsin's youth prisons. We'll get the details on that and other outcomes of a court settlement. As the school year winds down in districts around the state, we'll meet Wisconsin's Teacher of the Year. And where are the jet cars and meals in pill form? A science writer looks at the technology we thought was coming but never did. And we'll pick up that series of profiles of candidates for governor starting Monday next week. A lot of Democratic candidates to check out. You can hear those profiles each day on Central Time at 4:55 and 6:55 each evening. You can also find them all as they appear on WPR.org. You can hear all that, plus look at some of the top news stories of the day. It's coming up Monday right here on Central Time.